Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 1st of August. It's August, right? Yes, it is. Deep thanks to Mr. Radio Man, John Munson, for hosting for me the last 2 weeks while I was on vacation, looking at the July sky, swimming, kayaking, eating lots of walleye, and reading a lot of novels, including Dickens. I finally got to Dickens and watching the water go by, northern Wisconsin and later in northern Minnesota. So it was a good 2 weeks. The first hour of the program, and I anticipated that, not that this would be happening last night, but certainly the news has been dominated by the debt ceiling. And we are going to be talking about that a good chunk of the first hour of the program with one of our regular guests, Julian Zelizer. Congressional leaders, as you know, and President Obama did announce last night that they've cut a deal to avert a U.S. default, putting together a framework that it cuts some spending immediately. I'm still unclear as to what's going to be cut here, so perhaps Julian knows more about this. And we'll use a super Congress to slash more in the future. Julian Zelizer has written about this extensively, and he gives us a historical perspective today as well, because he says focusing on deficit reduction has been a longstanding strategy for proponents of conservatism ever since modern liberalism took hold in the 20th century. Whenever liberals make progress on their policy agenda, conservatives' best bet has been to talk about the budget. And he writes extensively about what happened in the mid-30s when conservative Democrats and Republicans began using FDR's record of deficits. Spending is one of the key arguments in their attacks against him. He'll talk more about that. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He is the author of a number of books, including Jimmy Carter, Conservatives in Power, The Reagan Years, 81 to 89, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, and The Presidency of George W. Bush, A First Historical Assessment. Coming up soon, Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He writes a weekly column for CNN.com. And he has been all over the news, writing extensively his political analysis. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Zelizer, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I loved your first sentence here today. Let's talk about it. Just because a drag race doesn't end with someone getting killed, it doesn't mean that drag racing is a safe thing to do. It looks like Congress will raise the debt ceiling, but this is no way to run a government.
Yes. I was writing about the process through which we dealt with the spending cuts that are now going to happen. And the point was not a debate about, the cuts or what should we have revenue increases, but tying this all to the debt ceiling, a routine decision usually by members of Congress to, keep the government afloat and keep the economy healthy, was rather a dramatic tactic. And the Tea Party Republicans really pushed their leadership to hold the government hostage to make sure these spending cuts went through. And I think it was a dangerous game they played. It looks like we're going to get out of it, it seems at least, depending on the vote. But I don't think this is the kind of tactic, that can be used repeatedly, because it can clearly go badly. We were only days away from, real financial chaos.
Right. Tell me how the focus shifted. I can remember not very long ago, were focusing on jobs, we're focusing on a stimulus, and now we're focusing on massive cuts. How did the Republicans succeed, and who were the Republicans who succeeded in completely changing the conversation?
Well, I think the party as a whole, led by the House Republicans, Speaker Boehner, allied with the Tea Party Republicans on the message, have been very effective since 2010. They fundamentally shifted the conversation in American politics away from using government, which had been the first 2 years of President Obama's administration, and jobs toward the deficit. The deficit trumped all other issues. And this was, a very deliberate strategy by the Republicans. It's one that's been used for decades against American liberalism, and we do have a large deficit. But I think, you know, Boehner and the Tea Party Republicans and the Republican Party more generally were very effective in the last 8-9 months at putting all of the public attention on this issue, first with the budget battle, which almost resulted in the shutdown of the government, and then now with this debt ceiling battle. And what's remarkable is President Obama conceded a long time ago, even these last few weeks. You know, it wasn't a debate over whether the deficit should be our focus right now, or even if we should have tax increases to reduce the deficit. It was simply about how far we should go in the spending cut. So the Democrats conceded a long time ago, and I think on policy, this is a major Republican victory.
Why did the Democrats concede, and why did the president concede a long time ago?
Well, the House Democrats, I think, conceded because they don't have much confidence in the president. I think you have a caucus on Capitol Hill that doesn't trust this president, that believes in the end he will make a deal with the Republicans, and he's not willing to fight on some of these issues, or he's fearful of fighting. And so I think, you know, they only were half-hearted in pushing for this because they figured in the end this is exactly what was going to happen, what happened last night. And if the president's not behind you and you don't control one chamber in Congress, there's not much that you can do. A lot of people don't have confidence in Senator Reid either, at being able to withstand Mitch McConnell, who's been a very effective legislator. You know, President Obama's the mystery. You know, one theory is that he doesn't have it in him to fight. He's just not a very aggressive, powerful, or effective politician. And in the end, the Republicans have just bested him again and again. That's one idea. The other is that he didn't have much choice. The House Republicans, because they were willing to do this, because they were willing to go so far and actually not raise the debt ceiling, put him in a position where really there was nothing he could do unless he was willing to see what happens with the economy next week if we defaulted.
Tell me what this deal, if it goes through, and we'll ask if you think it will, is going to do to what is a mission right now and what a lot of people would like to see the government focus on, and that's, you know, stimulating the economy and creating jobs for people. This is a rough economy.
Well, this isn't a stimulus package. It's the opposite.
Right.
Clearly, you know, this will take money out of the economy. I think most people would agree with that. There's two stages. The first stage is going to be these across-the-board cuts, which will hit most discretionary spending, most agencies. It's unclear where the cuts are going to be. And then there'll be a second round of cuts that have to be proposed by a joint congressional committee with a penalty of very severe cuts in everything from the budget to Social Security if Congress can't do it. This takes money out of the economy. It takes money out of people's hands. It will take money out of contractors' hands. And many people are very concerned that given how weak the economy is right now, Wall Street might be happy about the news, but Main Street won't be happy about the news. And this will, in fact, undercut President Obama even further going into the next election because you will have this laggard economy. The conservative response is that by reducing government, you will stimulate economic growth. And that is that response. But at least on paper, it's hard to see in the short term how you'll have a stimulative effect from this.
In the New York Times, I think yesterday, there was a front page story saying this. Tell me if you agree or not. Mr. Obama could be left because he didn't fight for more stimulus spending, with an economy still producing so few jobs by Election Day that his reelection could be threatened.
Absolutely. Look, his reelection already is threatened. The best thing he has going for him is the apparent inability of the Republicans to put forward a strong candidate and some of the glaring weaknesses in the potential candidates who we've heard from. But, you know, now President Obama is far into his presidency, and the economy is in bad shape. It might have been worse had he not been president, but that's not an argument you take to the campaign trail. Now he has angered many liberals when the cuts become clear that we're going to see in the next few years. And more importantly, it's unclear what this president is about. So to have a president with a weak economy and a blurry, muddled message and an opposition that seems quite powerful in terms of setting the agenda is not the best strategy to run on. Again, I think what he's counting on is the weaknesses in the Republican Party rather than his own strengths. And that's a risky strategy going into an election.
You brought us back to 1937 in a piece a couple days ago in Salon.com, and you examine FDR agreeing to start balancing the budget by cutting spending. That did not fare well for him.
No, it was terrible. He was under pressure then, also from conservatives within his administration and in Congress, to balance the budget or to try to balance the budget. FDR was committed to doing this, just that when the economy had recovered, there were people in the administration, including the Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, who was a fiscal conservative, who thought the time was right in 37 to start cutting spending. Congress cut spending based on his proposal, and we go into a major recession. His opponents would call it the Roosevelt Recession. And in 1938 midterms, it has a negative effect on him. And conservatives in Congress do quite well on the midterm. So they get the budget cuts, and then a recession comes, and FDR suffers politically. That is exactly, I think, what many of Obama's supporters are fearing will play out again. You lose, and then you lose again.
You also point to President Johnson and the Democratic leadership in Congress expanding the scope of government through the Great Society, and again, deficit reduction used, as you say, as a weapon to bludgeon liberals.
It was a big argument in the 1966 midterm campaigns when conservatives start to come back in Congress. And the deficit's an effective argument. It was then, it is today, in that conservatives realize that people like specific government programs. If you ask them, should you cut Social Security, they say no. If you ask them, though, do you like government, they're often against government. So they like the specifics, but in the abstract, they're against government. The deficit's a powerful argument because it's about numbers, it's about a broad picture, and you don't talk about what's going to get cut in the next few years. Rather, you're talking about achieving a certain number. So conservatives used it very well against Lyndon Johnson in 66, and they increased their numbers going into 67 and 68 and put Johnson on the defense. And I think they've done it again very well. I mean, it was more effective in some ways in the battles against health care, because this is an argument that I thought resonated with a much broader part of the population.
Why is it that the president wasn't able to get through any kind of, when you consider the fact that the American public is for this, tax increases?
That's a big mystery. This is not the first time people have asked that. In December 2010, right after the midterm elections when Republicans had won the House, many people said that was his moment to not extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, to get some revenue that way, and to diminish some of the impact on spending. He decided not to. I do think he is a president who has been very fearful of his opposition, even when he has the upper hand. Even though the public has consistently agreed that that should be part of the package, President Obama has been very nervous about the argument that he is raising taxes. And I think in the last few weeks, there was zero chance he would get that in the package. I thought that was an illusion that he could get it in there. Once you're at this point in the debate where the Republicans have framed it, where they were controlling the timing because of this default date, President Obama really was in a weak position. But he's a fearful politician. He's not an aggressive president, and I think we've now learned this about his leadership style. He lets others set the terms of the debate, and then he tries to work within that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the spending cuts before we go to phone calls. Is this a lengthy compromise, do you know, that was agreed on last night? And are there pages and pages of spending cuts that people will have to pore over before they vote?
I can't imagine. I mean, I haven't seen what this is. They want to vote today. Speaker Boehner wants to have the vote by tonight. They don't have much time left. So if it is long, most members are just going to get the bullet points and vote based on that, and more importantly, based on pressure from Boehner that if they don't do this, they'll be held to pay. But I think it's going to be, across the board slashes. That's the only way you're going to hit a number like this in the first round. But members are not going to have that much time to look through this. I think it's, based on what the discussions have been in the past few weeks. It's based on that.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest for All Things Political this first day of August, and we're going to go to your phone calls. Of course, the big news is the debt ceiling and the agreement that was reached last night and what the Senate and the House are likely to do. And I guess the larger overall question is, how do we get to this state? 800-486-8655 is our number. Chrissy Pease is answering phone calls. She'll chat with you, and we'll be with you on the air momentarily. A couple lines are open. They will be crowded, I'm sure, because people want to talk about this. So grab your spot in line, 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to go that route, is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your calls, Keith in Milwaukee is first. Hi, Keith.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a different theory about Obama's motivations. I believe he's actually doing exactly what he wants to do. Time and time again, the public's been behind progressive policies by large margins, and yet he's gone against that. He had a chance to get a clean bill to raise the debt limit, which he rejected because he wants the Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid cuts in there. And I think he's been just an incredible disappointment.
That is another argument I think many progressives are starting to wonder about, at least, that this isn't simply a political response. This is who he is. That in the end, he's, you know, more... he's not just a Bill Clinton Democrat. He's more conservative than Bill Clinton. And I do think there's some fears running through the progressive community about this. And that in the end, this is what he wanted. And we shouldn't just talk about the constraints on Capitol Hill and the conservative nature of the population, that this agenda is what's coming out of the White House. We don't know that. There is some contradictory evidence from advisors, from his own past, that this is not all he wants at all, and that the first couple of years suggest he had a more ambitious vision. But the fact he's such an enigma at this point, I think, is a problem. All presidents are enigmatic, and they compromise, and they have different ideas, and they anger just about everyone. But the great presidents, at their core, have a certain set of principles that people know in terms of what they're about. Whether you hate them or whether you love them, you know what they stand for. And I don't think people know what President Obama stands for. I think he's remained, or he's become more of an enigma since taking office than he had been before. And I think that could be a political problem for him.
Keith, thanks for the call. Robert in Sun Prairie, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that when this is all said and done, we need to have a debate about the role of government. And I'd like to alert you and your guests, if you Google Lincoln, the role of government, just Google that, Lincoln, the role of government, and what he says is, the legitimate object of government is to do for the people what they need to have done, but which they cannot do at all or cannot do so well for themselves in their separate and individual capacities. There are many such things, roads, bridges, and the like, providing for the helpless, young, and afflicted, common schools, the criminal and civil justice department. In other words, Lincoln had a very practical view of government, which is actually a little more progressive than you would, than a lot more progressive than the current Republican bunch. And he believed that there is an essential, necessary role of government, a safety net that we need to take care of each other. Now, they have stolen this debate. They have talked about limited government and shrinking the government, when in fact, these government services are essential. And this is backed up by President Lincoln, the first Republican.
Professor Zelizer.
I think, you know, there is an argument that Democrats don't have a guiding idea at this point. And one of the things that make the Republicans so potent is not just procedural power or election tricks. But what it is they have a fundamental idea about why government is generally bad on domestic issues. At least that's their argument. They don't always live by that. And the deficit became a way to encapsulate that idea. And so, you knew what the Republicans were about. They targeted this deficit, and they went after it. You didn't hear Democrats drawing on a long tradition of Democratic and Republican presidents, congresspeople, and activists who make a case for government in terms of why we need government and what government does. You saw a little of that after Paul Ryan proposed the cuts in spending, and people came out to the defense of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. But in general, Democrats have fought from a defensive position. And again, what you've heard from most Democrats, including the White House, is we can't cut that much, rather than why we shouldn't be cutting or why, you know, government program A is very important to the health of the nation. And that's a question about the party. I think it's a big question, but I do think it's rather striking how little you hear in terms of what government can do from the party that's supporting it.
Can we talk just a little bit about military spending? From the news I was hearing yesterday, this thing almost unraveled because it would, if that provision went in place of mandatory cutting, if the Congress couldn't live up to this bargain, that military spending would be included, and this threw the Republicans for a loop, and they said they wouldn't be able to support this. I don't know what happened behind the scenes, but military spending does seem to be sacrosanct.
Well, and I think that's still an open question today as the vote takes place. Mm. Look, Republicans, there's a big difference between the arguments they make and the way in which they govern. The reality is government has grown under every Republican administration. Republicans have pushed for all kinds of government. Military defense is always off the table, almost until now, in terms of spending cuts and many other programs, including Social Security and Medicare, have been defended by Republicans and other kinds of subsidies for industry. So you know, Republicans and government have a very complex relationship. We're just talking about the arguments, not necessarily what they practice. But this is, I think, a source of controversy today as the vote takes place. The second round of cuts that has to be proposed by a bipartisan congressional committee has these penalties they built in that if they can't reach an agreement, there are going to be very big cuts on the Democratic side on Social Security and Medicare, I believe, and Medicaid was left out, I believe, and military spending is also on the table, and many Republicans are like, that's too dangerous, we can't afford those kind of cuts. But, you know, there is where Republicans make, in some ways, a more powerful pro-government argument than Democrats about how this area is essential, and we need government to do this, meaning spending on our defense. And the passion with which they defend the military budget is something you almost never see from Democrats in social policy.
Thanks, Robert. Linda in Prairie du Sac. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having an intelligent conversation and putting this in context. What I'd like to hear is comment from the guest on what is happening in American media that, you know, we can, when the economists are recommending stimulus for job creation and the analysis shows that actually cutting the Bush era tax cuts would, you know, stimulate the economy and help with the budget, how is the entire conversation over the last month about, you know, this power struggle over increasing the deficit ceiling when that has never been an issue before, but the media somehow loses the context and loses the experts and gets into the sensationalist kind of, you know, hype that scares the public and accomplishes basically, you know, again, gutting the middle class. Could you comment on the media?
Well, there's two parts of that. I mean, the first part is the argument that you'll hear from economists like Paul Krugman, that really what we should be focused on now is how do you stimulate this economy, and in talking about deficit reduction, what's this going to do to the jobs that are not there and the lack of jobs, which fuels even Tea Party Republicans, and that there hasn't been as much attention to this. The deficit arguments and the deficit focus has been, you know, the almost sole thing that you can read about or hear about, and that those voices on the liberal side were crowded out. And so, you know, some would say that's the media. Others would say those arguments are just not gaining political traction, and the media is responding to it, that they'll print some of that, They'll quote some of that, but that's not what is captivating the public imagination. The second part is the process, which, you know, troubled me. I wrote something about it today. You know, it is rather dramatic, again, to use this debt ceiling increase to insist on a very specific spending cut. And I do think the media gets swept up naturally in the ins and outs and what was happening every day with the different leaders and trying to control their party. But if you step back, the drama of a party deciding to use this mechanism to pursue its objective, given the consequences that might happen if this doesn't go through today and tomorrow, is rather dramatic. It's not about gridlock. It's not about dysfunctional government. This is a deliberate partisan strategy that was undertaken. And I think we need to step back and see kind of how did the party reach this point and what are the consequences of dealing with policy through this kind of hostage-taking mechanism.
Because on the other hand, to get back to jobs, which concerns me and many of our listeners, I still wonder what will be the outcome of all of these spending cuts in terms of loss of jobs. We've already seen government jobs being cut in states all over the country. When we're trying to build the economy, to build jobs, it seems to me as though the effect of this will be to lose even more jobs. Am I off base?
No. So, I mean, certainly in the short run, it's impossible to see that not happening. You're going to, you know, practically lose jobs as the funding is cut, and at the same time, you're taking money out of the economy, which is not something that stimulates the economy. You know, there is a conservative response that slowly this will reignite the economy because government is just a bad thing for markets. But it's hard to see that in the short term. So we're just looking into the next year when these cuts start to go into effect, when in states from Wisconsin to New Jersey to California, you know, offices are being closed down, people are laid off in government jobs, government contracts dry up.
Right.
This is not going to help the economy. So we're probably, you know, looking at an economy that gets worse, not better, as a result of this package in the short term.
But, you know, it's interesting. The more we talk, the more I realize that message that you just gave, we don't hear about, do we? It really shows how effective those who have made deficit reduction their number one issue are winning this whole dialogue.
Oh, absolutely. The connection between what we do today and tomorrow and this bigger problem, frankly, that we faced in the last year where people are suffering, can't make ends meet, there has been a disconnect between the two. It hasn't even been debated. It's not as if you have conservatives and liberals, you know, really making intelligent and in-depth arguments about what will this do. That's just been off the table. The assumption is we need to cut the deficit now, and we need to take really big steps now, not in a year or two. And the economic consequences have generally gone ignored. And again, for the Democrats, I think that's been a big problem because that was probably the most powerful argument they had in terms of questioning doing this right at this moment.
Linda, thanks for the call. An email from Dave in Menominee. I think the president is a realist. Democrats lost too many seats in the last election. Obama knows the numbers and knows what's possible. To think Obama was going to get some Democratic policies past the Tea Party Republicans just isn't feasible. FDR had an enormous advantage in both houses and was able to accomplish so much more, even added to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, you know, I hear that argument, and it's a common argument. It's many of Obama's supporters talk about this. This is all the guy could really do, and the criticism from liberals or his party is often unfair because it's not looking at the makeup of Congress and the courts. That said, you know, most presidents, right and left, face horrible circumstances on Capitol Hill. It's just not an easy institution to deal with. The great presidents find their way around those obstacles, and I think that's what we're always looking for. They look at how the natural gridlock of Congress, that's what the institution is made to do. How do you overcome that? How do you build coalitions that go beyond what seems possible at the time? You know, it's not as if Lyndon Johnson had an easy playing field in the 1960s, or even FDR, frankly. in the 1930s. It wasn't clear the New Deal would be successful. And that's what these presidents do, similarly with Ronald Reagan and his agenda from the right. So the realism argument, I'm sympathetic to it, but if we can't kind of place all the blame there and we can't relieve President Obama of responsibility for some of his losses and some of his failures. Mm.
Andrew in Ashland, hi.
Hi. Oh, I guess I have a slightly different take on all of this.
All right.
I mean, I think the irony, I mean, it's kind of funny listening to this program because you could, I think, easily make the argument that this package they put together didn't go nearly far enough. I mean, it calls for $1 trillion in cuts immediately and then puts another $1 trillion in the hands of committees, and we know where that ends up going, nowhere. And meanwhile, you have the S&P say, you know, in order to avoid a downgrade, you need $4 trillion in cuts over 10 years. And they don't even come close to that in this package. So it's just kind of funny hearing how you're saying that the Republicans have taken over this debate, or conservatives, and, you know, from my perspective, being conservative, conservatives haven't even come close to taking over this debate. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why Democrats are so much on the defensive here is you just have to look across the pond at Europe and see what happens when government spending gets out of control.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, those are all fair points, and again, points you were hearing a lot of. You know, the downgrade also depends on the health of the economy, and that gets back to the missing argument here, that if this doesn't revive the economy and it really undermines where we are and prevents the possibility of growth in the next few years, that won't help our standing financially either. It is true that conservatives wanted much grander cuts, some conservatives, and the cuts that we are going to see didn't go far enough. But that said, that's not an equal kind of playing field, so to speak, or an equal outcome. You know, most Democrats weren't focused on these issues right now. And so for the Republicans, it's did we get enough cuts? Whereas for Democrats, it's how did the entire agenda shift to the other side within a relatively short period of time. And according to what we're hearing, at least on the initial reports, this joint legislative committee is not simply a committee that will have the power to do nothing, which I do understand as a fear that many conservatives will have. Again, according to what we're hearing, there is this penalty, a rather large penalty, if they don't propose something or don't pass something where everything from Social Security to military spending to, you know, sacrosanct items for both parties will be cut if they don't take action. So it's not just a committee has to recommend something. It's a committee has to recommend something or else.
What do you do if you're Nancy Pelosi meeting with members, progressive members of your party this morning or this afternoon? How do you whip up support for this? Is she likely to do that? Are they going to lose the progressives in the House?
I don't know. I mean, you know, one method Speaker Minority Leader Pelosi will have is to use fear and warn and threaten members that if they don't go along with the president, there'll be consequences, from taking away campaign funds to committee assignments to whatever else she can muster to make sure those votes come through. The other, which I think, you know, Democrats, it's been a constraint on Democrats from the start, is they don't want the debt ceiling to not be raised, and they don't want a default and the consequences of that. They're aware of the kind of financial pain that would happen in the next 2 months if that outcome happened. So the Republicans had Pelosi and the Democrats from the start. If you're willing to do that, it's hard for the Democrats really to win the debate. And my assumption is Pelosi will again outline to Democrats, if we vote against this, we will, you know, destroy this president. We might destroy the party. And most importantly, there will be horrible economic consequences for Democrats and Republicans in the next few months. We are a party without a choice. choice. And I assume that's the message. It's not a message that's going to be positive. It's not a message of optimism. I think it's more a message of at this point, this is our only option.
And if you're John Boehner dealing with members of the Tea Party today, if he's the one who's going to deal with them, maybe somebody else is, how do you handle them? Do you just assume those votes are not to be found?
There'll be some Tea Party Republicans who are not going to go along with this, and for the kind of arguments that we just heard from a caller, I assume some others will in the end. They're still getting, again, a pretty big victory. You know, even though they're unhappy with the number, this is still a pretty big number, and it's still a pretty big victory against the president. There's no way to call this a Democratic victory. There's just no way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume he'll appeal to that. I assume, you know, he'll appeal to the idea that if they could get this within a year, think about what more they can do in the next year and possibly winning a presidential election. And they're not going to get anything more at this point. And the deal's been approved by the leadership of the Republican Party. And I assume he's going to make that, you know, very clear that they need to accept victory now. And you can't win and not accept the victory because then you'll never have that celebration.
Julian Zelizer, our guest for All Things Political this first day of August, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books, presidential books, Jimmy Carter, The Reagan Years, and also the first assessment of the presidency of George W. Bush. Those are just a few of his books. He's currently working on Governing America, the Revival of Political History. Our phone number, Andrew, thanks for your call. We have one line open, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Monday, the American Medical Association recently announced that it was taking a stand against image manipulation in advertising like Photoshop. We'll be talking about how media and popular culture can negatively impact body image. Our guest is the co-author of So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. Back to phone calls. Joe in Fox Point. Hi.
Good morning, a great show as always. I know we're all getting caught up in the details about this deal and that deal and the various aspects of the different deals, but I think it's important to step back and recall that the stated purpose of the Republican Party, this is Mitch McConnell within months, if not weeks, after President Obama was elected, was to ensure that he would not gain a second term. And to that end, I think all of us need to just understand there's virtually nothing the Republicans wouldn't do to ruin the economy, to drive unemployment higher, to push us to the edge of default and ruination of our credit rating for political purposes. And they will make sure this commission is going to be, I think it's going to be silly. No Republican on this Super Congress commission will have any motivation to reach a deal because they can say, oh, we tried to reach a deal, but we just couldn't do it. So, gee, I guess those automatic cuts are just going to have to go into effect. And boom, there you go, excuse me, with destroying the economy for next year. That's all.
Thank you for the call, Joe. Professor?
Yeah, some people think that this Republican strategy has been to do just that, meaning to take steps to harm the economy, that this is not an issue that hasn't been thought through, just the opposite. And the idea is President Obama will be set up in 2012 with a weak economy, with high unemployment figures, and an argument for Republicans that how can you allow this to happen for four more years. I don't know if that's true. You know, you hear that, and it's still at some level hard to fathom that the entire party is okay with really harming the economy, with causing a great pain for many Americans. I mean, I do think there are many Republicans who genuinely belief in the arguments they're making and feel that in the long run this is healthier, that the deficit is a problem and that less government is better for the health of the economy. But, you know, it's good. That fear will loom. And I think the Tea Party Republicans have fueled that suspicion in that they are so willing to take drastic measures with drastic consequences that at some level you wonder, you know, what they're about and what the limits are of their political tactics. But you know, I think there are many Republicans who, like Democrats, have a genuine philosophical, ideological outlook about what needs to be done to revive the economy.
What is the pain that many Americans will feel?
They will feel not having their jobs or fearing losing their jobs. That's a lot to live with. And, you know, your job ultimately is a key marker of your economic health. For, you know, almost every person living in this country, barring those who don't need that. And everything then falls from that, from mortgage to rent payments to food and children. And the unemployment rate we have had is intolerable. It's just too high. It has not fallen. And everyone in the White House knows at the political level this is a big, big problem because you are going to have unhappy voters if this continues, rightfully so. I think most people in the White House would agree, and they haven't been able to crack this problem.
Jay in Milwaukee, hi.
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 Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I believe the Democratic Progressive side lost the debate by allowing Tea Partiers to dominate, bully, and lie, especially at the town hall meetings. If we hadn't been cutting taxes drastically for so long, we wouldn't be having this deficit unemployment issue, and we probably could have afforded to even pay for national health care and wouldn't have cost so much for individuals. I agree with the previous caller immediately prior to my call. I think there's some real non-allegiance on the part of one party. I really think they're flirting with very a non-allegiance issue to this country.
Well, the second part, you know, I think most Republicans are as committed to the country as any Democrat. And, you know, I do think they believe they are fighting for a cause, and I do think they're willing to take rather drastic measures to fight for that cause. And I take them on face value that way, like I hear Democrats, and I listen to them the same way. But I do think the origins of the deficit are important. And the deficit started under President Bush, not President Obama, and the tax cuts were absolutely central to starting to gut the surpluses that we had under President Clinton. Military spending for Afghanistan and Iraq were both key to, you know, ballooning deficits. And Medicare prescription drugs, which passed under President Bush, not President Obama, was also important. So by the time President Obama took office, the deficit problem was already there. This is not simply a Democratic creation. Not that Democratic spending has not contributed to this and been important to it, but both parties have a role to play. You know, the Tea Party did start as a protest against TARP, against President Bush, as much as President Obama. I do think that's true. And I think many Tea Party Republicans, if you listen to them, they aren't just frustrated with the president. They're frustrated with their own party leadership. And I think Speaker Boehner's aware of this. And they really didn't listen to what he said. He wanted a compromise a long time ago. But I think the caller in the first point is correct. This is a bipartisan creation. And I think, you know, Republicans have been better at just focusing on the Democratic programs that contributed to the deficit.
Because history is also one of your specialties, let's return to previous presidents. And as you remind us, the one Republican who took deficit reduction seriously and paid a steep price for accepting tax increases as a part of a budget package in 1990.
Yeah, President Bush, the first President Bush, it was a, you know, it's a rather dramatic moment when we look back on it. And in 1990, he worked with the Democratic Congress, people like Dan Rostenkowski, who was then the Ways and Means Chairman. The deficit was a very big issue, and they agreed to an important package of spending cuts and tax increases. And President Bush had run in 1998 with his famous Read My Lips, No New Taxes line, and he went against what he had said. And in the White House's estimation, this was important, and he was in favor of compromise and negotiation, and many Republicans never forgave him. For Newt Gingrich, who was then the minority whip, I believe, you know, would never be supportive of that, of the first President Bush. He walked out of the meeting. He spoke poorly about him through the 92 campaign. Many Republicans said they weren't enthused about the president in 92 because of that tax increase. And for many Republicans since then, that's been a defining moment. It wasn't a Democrat who they're continually fighting against. It's the memory of a Republican, a Republican who betrayed this idea that taxes should never be increased. They don't talk about President Reagan also increased taxes, but that deficit reduction plan in 1990 continues to shape our politics into today.
Tom is next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. I would like to sort of tag on to what one of your previous callers said about he was referring to one party or the other being, I think he said, disloyal or something like that to the United States. The point I'd like to make simply is that I don't think either of the two parties we have today are what they should be. The Democrats of today, what really upsets me is when the term progressive gets thrown around. I'm not sure when the Democrats sort of usurped or hijacked that term. To me, a progressive would be somebody like Theodore Roosevelt. He was, I think, probably the only true progressive president this country's ever seen. And he was a Republican. The Republicans of today do not look back to Abraham Lincoln, or they do not look back to Theodore Roosevelt. They look back to Ronald Reagan as their patron saint. So I think both political parties have to take the blame for the condition of the United States today, and I'd just be interested in what your guest has to say about that.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, what the caller is talking about is the polarization of the parties in the last two decades, and the first part of his question is about where did the progressive Republicans go? And they were around really through the 1950s and even the 1960s, and since then they have just diminished. The Republican base, the base of the party, shifted to the South, and the party became much more conservative on everything from social to military policy. And Democrats lost their center, that's true. Southern Democrats became Republicans, and that party moved toward the coasts and on many issues became more liberal, or at least had less of a center that was willing to reach agreement with Republican aims. So you've had these two polarized parties in the 90s. In the last 10 years, it's become worse and worse, and it's hard to find the kind of center that you still could see in the 1950s and 60s. And for some, that's dysfunctional, that if you have two parties like this, you're never going to have parties where you can form the kind of coalitions that people like a Lyndon Johnson really depended on.
Bill in Madison, hi.
Yes, I think what people are forgetting what is, like, for example, I don't know, three or four callers ago, a conservative caller mentioned Europe as a classic example of what happens when you overspend. Well, he's talking about Greece and Portugal and Spain. Germany, on the other hand, since World War II, has been fiscally rock solid all the way through. Before, when it had the D-mark, and now when it has the euro. In fact, it's single-handedly pretty much floating the euro. Yet, they have a progressive political agenda in place. They have substantial social safety nets. They have substantial investments in public infrastructure and in research. They have the highest per capita export rate in the world, despite the fact that they have an expensive currency and some of the most expensive labor in the world.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, look, you know, debating politics is all about cherry picking, and people on both sides love to pick the country that suits their needs, and Greece has suddenly become the model for conservatives to talk about where this country is going. often ignoring many other countries that are doing just fine, that are economically healthy, where government spending and government policy is integral to the economy, to society and social benefits, and it hasn't been a problem. And the comparison with the U.S. and Greece, given our economies, is also a bit suspect. But again, that gets back to a call earlier that said, you know, the liberal part of this discussion has been absent, and it's notable, the defense of social policy and what it can do, and comparisons to countries other than Greece, where a government has a very functional and healthy role in healthy economies, is also absent. But I do think, you know, if Democrats want to respond more effectively, they're going to have to craft a much better debate that points to these kinds of issues, or people will see Greece, they'll see the United States, and they'll buy the comparison. And on that, you know, on that grounds, Republicans will win.
And we only have about 30 seconds left, but I've interviewed you many times. You sound particularly upset today about all of this.
I'm more upset about the process than the policy. Look, policy, there's all kinds of debates, and I don't want to take sides, but I do think in terms of using the debt ceiling to force a specific policy outcome, and they didn't do it symbolically, they were actually threatening to not raise the debt ceiling. I think that's a dangerous kind of politics, and we can resolve differences or even push for spending cuts through the normal budget process. And I think, you know, there has to ultimately be limits to the kind of tactics parties are willing to use.
Mm. Thank you, as always. You're a great guest. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books. He's working on one right now, which will come out soon, Governing America, the Revival of Political History. He also, you can hear, read about his comments. He has one today on CNN.com about the agreement that was reached yesterday, and he writes a weekly column. Plus, you see him writing in many other publications. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing and on-air producing.